conversation with Wyatt T. Walker, Atlanta, March 18. Continue. Where were we?
I don't recall. Let's see.
Well, let's just start something. Just pull a card out of the deck. This is a quotation on Negro history. The whole tendency of the Negro history movement, not as history, but as propaganda, is to encourage the average Negro to escape the realities, the actual achievements, and the actual failures of the present. Although the movement consciously tends to build race pride, it may also cause Negroes unconsciously to recognize that group pride is built partly on delusion and therefore may result in a devaluation of themselves for being forced to resort to self-deception. This is from Arnold Rose, Middle's collaborator.
Well, I see a couple holes there. I think we must honestly face the fact that almost every page of history, and I know generalizations are bad, are romanticized to a degree. Now, what I'm saying is that I would imagine that as the new move for Negro history is developed, and I am intimately involved in just such a project myself, that some of the Negro's history and his contributions and the establishment of his historical roots will be romanticized to a degree, maybe overdrawn. But this is nothing more than that which is natural. I think someone has said that it is a character of the human spirit that the further removed you become from a event, the more and more it becomes embellished. And I think this is something that is a part of our humanity, rather than to say that something unique is now happening to the Negro because he has an interest in Negro history. I'm about to take a leave of absence from my work with Dr. King by a project that I kind of backed into. I really had no interest whatsoever earlier because my appetite was one of being an activist, militant. But the offer kept on coming, and then I began to be interested in what these people are trying to do. I'm planning to go to work with a company that's putting out a 16-volume encyclopedia on Negro life and culture. Now, either I have persuaded myself or I have become persuaded that this, in a sense, is the next frontier. To give to the Negro, this present generation and the next, a sense of historical rootage, which he has never had. It's, in a sense, going to solidify this new identity that he's building. I don't know whether you've been able, I guess you know, that I'm a damn Yankee.
Yes, I know your origins.
And I went to integrated schools all my life. And the only thing I can recall reading in the history books about Negroes that we were slaves, and that slave owners, for the most part, there were a few, I'm paraphrasing now, there were a few slave owners who didn't treat their slaves well, but for the most part, a genuine and warm relationship existed, you know. And that's all I can really recall. I'm sure I don't have any mental block about it, because I've never had any feeling about denying the slave experience of the Negro. And this has grown out of my deep appreciation for what is almost the only thoroughly American music we have, the Negro spiritual and folk songs. Rather, to me, despite the terrible experience slavery was, it was an ennobling experience for the Negro because he has proven that he could rise above it. That he took the rigors that it produced and somehow kept his spirit and soul together. And I've become convinced that whatever efforts I have, that more people are reached through the written word than the spoken word, in a sense. And so this new project is really fascinating to me. that if we can get into, say, 2/5, 2/10 of the Negro church communities, if we can get in 1/10 of the public schools in America, get in 1/2 of the libraries, get in 1/10 of civic and human relations groups, with these volumes, which will talk about the Negro and his contributions to medicine, which is a kind of neo-nationalism, in sports, in religious life, Negro womanhood, you know, essays, literature, you know, the whole gamut of experiences that he has been able at best to develop within his subculture. This is really fascinating to me.
It is. Programmatic history can be the kind that was written by the South about the Reconstruction.
Yes. Which guided their thought patterns for the next two generations.
That's right. It guided them very unfortunately.
Yes.
Now we are finding a crop of Southern historians who are rewriting it.
Yes.
New researches.
Very, and it's been very shocking to some.
Very shocking, but say that Van Woodward has rewritten Reconstruction history.
Yes.
He's a Southerner from Arkansas. Now, this, the question I'm getting at is, there is a danger, it's such a program, isn't there? The danger of the delusion.
Yes.
The danger of delusion.
Yes. Over-romanticizing it. Of building a deep nationalistic spirit, of making black better than white, you know.
Or
developing the martyr complex.
That. Or even doing something else. Over-promoting.
Yes.
The great American vice in American history.
Yeah. Jumboism.
That's right. You said something a moment ago which struck my ear in passing. It was this. Before we come back to history, this bears on it. You said you regarded the slave experience as an ennobling one for the Negro. Now, in Faulkner's character of Dilsey in The Sound and the Fury, we have the only noble character in this novel. She's noble, understanding, powerful, enduring, pitiful, compassionate, I mean, that sense, pitiful. For some Negroes, this character is an affront. She's a character painted as being ennobled by her history and by her condition. Now, when Faulkner, a white man, says that, this causes resentment among certain Negroes, including James Baldwin.
Well, I think James...
Now, you said it can no sense cause of his act. You would have to say James Baldwin what?
I was going to say that James Baldwin... I recognize James Baldwin mechanically and artistically as a great writer, from my own judgment. But I cannot accept James Baldwin as the last word on Negro expression. What I feel. James Baldwin can speak for James Baldwin and what he feels. But that does not make him the archetype of expression for the Negro community. I don't think there's any person who speaks for the Negro community. Not even Martin Luther King Jr. I think he'd be the first one to say it. We are as individual as we are different. And we reflect a heterogeneity of attitudes and responses as does any group of people. White, black, yellow, or brown. James Baldwin... you kind of intimated with it, he did not find any comfort in the character Dilsey.
Southerners have an illusion and they cling to it desperately. And Dilsey is such an illusion that justifies the Southerner in saying, oh, everything's all right because she's so nice and she comforts me. That's
well,
I won't read the whole thing.
Yeah, I think a part of what he's saying may be true. Faulkner was a novelist, basically. Altogether. He drew some of his characters from experiences that he had had. I'm sure that these ennobling qualities that Dilsey had, and I'm not familiar with this particular book.
Yes.
I mean, I know the name, but I've never
read
it. That she might have been the composite of qualities that a slave person could develop despite the slave experience. And this is what I'm getting at.
That's what he's presenting.
Yes.
Too, I should
say. And I'm not saying that if I want to be ennobled, make me a slave. That is not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is, in spite of it developed in the Negro, which might have developed otherwise and maybe at a more accelerated pace, but it did not kill his spirit. It only broadened the resiliency of the human spirit, and it was by some accident or fortuitous circumstance that it happened that it occurred in the Negro experience. In other words, it did a lot of bad things to him, to us, but it didn't decimate us as did the Indians' inflexibility. See, in other words, if I had to choose between the two courses, I'd take the Negro's lot anyway and undergo the slave experience and survive rather than be relegated to a reservation as has the Indians.
Yes. You speak of heterogeneity among Negroes and among Negro leaders a moment ago. This is an interesting fact. Most revolutions tend to move toward a single focus of leadership.
Well, I have a little, maybe this explains it, I don't know. My attitude toward the revolution is that it is not quite gelled yet. It's finding its way. And I agree with you that any significant historical turn of events must move on the vehicle of personality. It does not move on idea alone. It must have substance. It must have personality. It must be substantive via personality. My feeling is that the revolution is like a child who is making its first few steps. A year ago I was saying we're just landing on the beaches, digging in. I think Birmingham stood us up, and we're like a toddling child now. Because when I think that when the revolution is full grown, we're going to have such things as removing the prerequisite of literacy as a right to vote, and that's right around the corner. We're going to have a demand for an economic reorganization of our whole free enterprise system. To me, that is the revolution full blown.
Now, but got back to leadership. Is there any tendency toward not a single person now visible? Not even Dr. King, who has become more the symbol than any other single person, but clearly does not dominate the whole impulse. There's a vast amount of energy in the movement that is not, or even outside the movement, is random violence, but he does not dominate. Is there any logic in the situation which would lead toward the domination by a single personality? There always has been a revolutionary. Or can you swing a revolution with a democratic control? Is that the presented problem that forces the face?
I would say no to the latter question and say not necessarily to the former. Now, to be specific, what I'm getting at is I don't think there are rules for a revolution, you know.
Yes.
That there is a possibility of a revolution occurring that doesn't conform to any of the other previous revolutions recorded in history. I think our span...
That's a good pragmatic view anyway.
Yes. So I would not be dismayed if there does not emerge on the American scene in race relations one Negro leader who towers above all else.
It might be very dangerous, as a matter of fact.
Yes. On the other hand, I think I might, I don't know, I have a kind of reluctance to agree that Martin Luther King does not now dominate the scene more than any other thing.
More than any other person, but not the whole scene. He doesn't dominate the
Muslims. Not the whole spectrum.
He doesn't dominate a great many factions and random feelings, too.
Well, let me ask you, what do you think the Muslim following represents, really?
Numerically?
Yes.
I have no way of knowing. I read the papers and I read the books and the articles. It's all what I read. How do I know?
Well, let us say, for instance, my feeling is that the Muslim movement and its so-called impact and its lever in race relations is almost nil. It's a specter, a paper tiger that the white press has created. I say the white press because that's the only press that exists in a real sense. For instance, I have a serious question as to how strong they are with all of the fear that they strike in some people's hearts. When I know in Birmingham, they say they have had a temple there for 10 years. And they have to scrounge around to get 50 people. Now, a movement that is no more vital than that in 10 years, I have some question about it. In Atlanta, the same thing is true. The only place, and you can document it, the only place Malcolm X can get a crowd is Harlem. That's maybe Newark, because it's in the shadow of New York. But you get him anywhere else, he's lost. 50% of Negroes don't even know what the black Muslims are. They never heard of them. They don't know who Malcolm X is. But 90% of Negroes know who Martin Luther King Jr. is.
Yes, I know that fact. I mean, that's beyond dispute. It's a question of what impulses are implicit, and needs and appetites and angers, you see, an instinct for violence and revenge that are implicit,
well, this
that
is,
are not dominated
yeah,
by him.
This is where I think a great many people have misjudged the real temper of the Negro. For instance, I would raise the question, who can best say what the temper of the grassroots Negro is? Can Roy Wilkins say it? No. Jim Farmer? No. Whitney Young? Certainly no. Who is it that enjoys titular leadership in the Negro community who really knows what the pulse of the simple and plain people are? There isn't one man who has a following and who has the logical contact. There isn't one man that moves at their level who has any kind of programmatic thrust that ever touches them. And that's Martin Luther King Jr.
Well, I say certainly in relative terms there's no denying. That's clearly true. Speaking of any...
What single man? Let me press it
please,
one point.
Please.
There is not a single Negro leader, not a single white leader, who touches as many people individually as does Martin Luther King Jr. I took a 6-week check following, when we came out of Birmingham. In less than 10 days' time, he personally, I mean, he saw hands and eyes and faces of nearly a better than 250,000 people. There isn't anybody who commands the kind of response, individual physical response that he does. Now, I'm not even counting the compound the contacts that he makes when they record his speeches and play them over the radio or when he's on television, such as he was at the March on Washington. And I think this is unique in the man, something that goes by the way. It's so ordinary for us that we are slow to detect it.
You remember this quotation from Mr. Wilkins? They, that is SNCC, CORE, SCLC, furnish the noise, but NAACP pays the bills,
mm-hmm.
the bail and all the legal advice and so forth, and of CORE and so forth. Here today and gone tomorrow. There's only one organization that can handle a long, sustained fight.
You just want my
candid response, not your uncandid response.
Off the record or on the record? I got
well,
two. I have two.
Give me both of them. You'll have a script. You can one background and one on the record. Put them both here, and we'll. You have a script anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, first I would say. I think Roy Wilkins, I know Roy personally, and I used to work under him for years until I got exiled to Siberia. Let me go into the off-the-record reflection.
All right,
The NAACP has become bureaucratic, or is bureaucratic. It has lost contact with the grassroots people. If it ever had it, it has lost it. I worked within... structure of the NAACP ever since I was 11 years old, so I know it pretty well. I mean, I'm not somebody on the outside looking in. I was a branch president for 5 years in Virginia, reputedly one of the best branches in the nation per capita.
That's when you had a charge there, passport.
Yes,
there.
That's right. And I think I could pretty well document that whenever within the loins of the NAACP energetic and or ambitious leadership begins to develop, you go to the guillotine. Why, I don't know. because it seems to me the life of any organization, if it's going to exist in perpetuity, must have some transfer. But out of my own experience and what I began to look around and see in other circumstances, I found it to be true. They have almost a kind of a organizational determinism, and it's reflected in this statement. This is on the record now. That the NAACP, because of its longevity, is the only organization. I cannot subscribe to that view. I think the discontent of the Negro takes many different forms. Here again, I'm talking, this reflects the heterogeneity of the Negro. And the NAACP's program is not versatile enough to take within itself all of these different impulses. Now, the first thing I would say about Mr. Wilkins' statement in Arlington, Virginia, is it was not factual. I remember a specific instance when SNCC, to whom he refers, got involved in Macomb, Mississippi. And the students do go off sometimes without counting the costs. This is not because they're students, it's the rebellious age of the human spirit. And in many instances, they have done things precipitatively, which were good, and in other instances, they were ill-advised. But all of us make mistakes. In that instance in Macomb, I remember that he needed either $20,000 bail or $10,000 bail. Whatever it was, Roy Wilkins called me personally and wanted to know, could we help with the bail? And they had appealed to us. And we agreed on the phone that they would put up half and we would put up half.
Now you being SCLC?
SCLC. This was back in 1961. In the Freedom Ride, which he intimates, Roy is not completely honest at this point, in that he says NAACP and embraces a legal defense and education fund, which is something altogether different. Even knowledgeable white people who are students of the revolution are not aware of this. And it was a legal defense and education fund that took up the cudgel of the Freedom Rides legally. And this is what they exist for, so they should have done it. Birmingham, which has been the biggest single confrontation to date that I know of. The NAACP does not exist in Alabama. I do not know of any single thing they did or paid, say, Mr. Wilkins' transportation from Tuskegee Institute over to Birmingham to speak and back up to New York. Now, that is the only involvement I know of them with Birmingham. And I can speak with authority because I'm the business agent. I'm the man who handles the bills and okays the requisitions and this kind of thing. Any city he wants to name, there have been some instances where the NAACP branch has become involved, or their youth chapters have become involved with the assistance, openly or quietly, by SCLC, or inspired by SNCC, goaded by SNCC, prodded by us, in which they have had some responsibility, but the job is being done under the aegis of the NAACP. And I think we just have to face the practical realities that in these civil rights organizations, with the diversified attack now on the system, the one point at which there is sharp competition is fundraising. Now, uniquely enough, even though we stay in the red, I think we have a broader outreach in fundraising than any organization that exists, and this is because of Martin Luther King Jr. He has a tremendous appeal.
I've seen it in operation in Bridgeport 2 weeks ago.
Oh, yes. Well, then you know exactly what I mean.
I've seen it elsewhere, too.
And, now, that was one evening's work, which was a rugged evening for him. And when you consider his overall schedule and the organizational responsibility he has, that was an $8,000 night. Now, Roy Wilkins, it would take, I don't know if he could ever get up a crowd that big to come hear him speak. He admits he's not colorful, he's not a symbol. Well, this is the symbolism of Martin Luther King Jr., and we practically translate it into meaningful support for his organization. There's a whole ream of untold stories about Martin Luther King Jr. as far as his income. He's not accepted an honorarium. For instance, he raised, to his appearances last year, raised better than $400,000 for his organization, which was over 50% of the budget or more, the budget expenditure, for which he got a dollar. See, he gets no personal income from this organization, all yet the stories persist, you know, about this man is making a mint. He's stashing it away. Well, I think I know more about the personal finances of Martin Luther King Jr. than any living person, save his wife and secretary. And I know of more offers that come to him which are legitimate and which he has every right to accept, but because of his unique symbolism, he is reluctant to do it. Many people do not know, and I don't know whether he won't hear, but Martin Luther King Jr. was born a wealthy man. He has no need. You know, there's no need exists.
I didn't say he was comfortable anywhere. I didn't know wealthy, but I didn't know.
I'd say within the frame of reference of what the Negro community, scale, you know, our scale is considerably lower, but with enough financial affluence not to ever have to hit a lick of work as long as he lived. Now, I could say that.
Going back to the matter of recent history,
I want to be sure I made clear that
first of all,
Mr. Wilkins' statement was not accurate. It was said in a moment of evident pique when it looked like NAACP was being displaced by the new vital.
The same thing was said by the local president of NAACP at Bridgeport while waiting for Dr. King's appearance 2 weeks ago in Bridgeport.
He said the same thing, Roy Wilkins?
Lady.
Yeah.
He wasn't there. I mean, the local president.
And just to show you, if I may press this one point further, that same lady, Mrs. Anderson, I know her by name, because and this is the practice of Dr. King and the many, they can't get a crowd unless they use the names of the movement. And it happens that King, Abernathy, Shuttlesworth, and Walker are the principal names. I went to Bridgeport for an NAACP rally, for expenses on, to raise money for the NAACP. Dr. King is going to Las Vegas the end of next month on a 60-40 basis. To raise money, 60% for the NAACP, you know. If they have Roy Wilkins that day, they can't get $25 or $100 a plate for a dinner, but they can do it, Martin Luther King Jr. He raises more money for other organizations than the people within the organization themselves can possibly do. Now, we have a letter, I believe, I haven't seen it with Dr. King remarked, that Gloucester Current wrote to us and thanking Dr. King that they had the largest membership last year they ever had. And it was because of Birmingham, you know, the interest group. Jim Farm, of course, has their income was strengthened. SNCC has benefited. Any number of organizations. We were the only organization, Legal Defense Education Fund, had one ad in the New York Times that grossed $110,000. We were the only organization who didn't send out a financial appeal on Birmingham. And you know why? Because we were still over there doing the job. We just couldn't do it.
Tell some people say, people who are quite active and courageous in this movement, that Birmingham was a disaster.
Well, without...
Charles Ellis, for one, I put it on tape.
Well, first of all, he is knowledgeable about the Negro movement in the South. He's been away from Mississippi too long. Secondly, you can't measure the results of a revolution altogether intangible results. And in the paper that I gave you,
it was very specific that
it was a direction-turning event, not just for a single city, but for the South and even the entire nation.
Was there a shock to your leadership an outbreak of violence there?
Not at all.
No shock. This is sometimes said, you know, even if the shock was great to your leadership. After the bombing when the mob broke, you know. I mean after the bombing of the motel when the mob broke.
You know what my shock was? I was on the scene in both instances.
I know you were.
I was in the motel when it was bombed. My shock was that we were successful in containing it to what it was. That was my shock.
The containment
of it. I really thought that city was going to blow itself off the map that night and the next day. There was enough provocation to warrant it. The other thing is, the reason why this assessment may come out is here again, we're at the mercy of, and I don't think they do it with any malice, white press corps who interpret it, they can only see it through white eyes. They cannot distinguish even between Negro demonstrators and Negro spectators. All they know is Negroes, and most of the spectacular pictures printed in Life magazine and in television clips, had the commentary, Negro demonstrators when they were not Negro demonstrators at all. I could go through reams of pictures and identify for you pictures depicted as demonstrators. They were not demonstrators at all.
Spectators.
If I could share with you a little intimacy off the record of what gave the movement, what built the Birmingham movement, was something that was an accident that we parlayed into its most useful application. When we went to Birmingham, as I don't know whether you know, 5 months ahead, I had started in at Dr. King's behest, preparing the community, organizing, mapping out the streets, etc. We had 400 people when we came to town April the 2nd, who we knew were ready to go to jail for 10 days apiece, and we were going to stagger this over a period of time. On the first Sunday of a demonstration, which I believe was a Palm Sunday, we had 23 people in the march. But you know how our mass meetings, they're like religious, they last a little while. We were about an hour behind schedule. And with the demonstrations that had begun that week with 15 and 8 and 12 and 20, the people who are free on Sunday, Negro people in a Negro neighborhood, began to stand around and wait to see what was going to happen. Well, it swelled to about 1,500 people. Only 22 people marched. See? But they followed these 22 people down the street, and when the UPI took the pictures and reported, they said 1,500 demonstrators, 22 arrested. Well, the 22 or 28 was all we had. So then we devised the technique. We said, well, this is the way we'll do it. We'll set the demonstration for 1 hour, delay it by 2 hours, and let the crowd collect. Now, this is a little Machiavellian, and I don't know whether I've ever discussed this with Dr. King. I doubt if I have, but some people say I'm the Richelieu or something, you know. And it was the image of all of these people following just a handful, and it was the spectators following upon whom the dogs were turned. It was only until 3 weeks later that hoses were actually used on demonstrators per se. And that was only done one afternoon. Isn't that interesting? But there were reports over and over again of...
The dogs, you mean, only one afternoon? The hoses?
No, the hoses.
One afternoon.
After that, they saw that didn't stop them, and they just started, they rented buses and pulled buses up and put them on. But one afternoon, one Saturday before the truce, I remember particularly, out of which came some of the most graphic pictures. We decided, since there had been a little rock throwing on Friday, that we would not have any